Hello, and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Michelle Flor-Cruz. Xenophobia and hate toward Asians and Asian Americans is a well-documented part of American history, from yellow peril to Japanese internment. Over the past year, hate crimes targeting Asians and Asian Americans have increased as a subset of the U.S. population has tried to place blame for the COVID-19 pandemic on people of Asian descent. These ongoing instances of anti-Asian hate came to a head nationally when 8 people were killed in a mass shooting spree at 3 spas in the Atlanta, Georgia area. 6 of the victims were Asian women. In this episode of Asia in Depth, Asia Society's president and CEO, Kevin Rudd, talks with 2 members of the Asia 21 Young Leaders Network, Bing Chen, chairman and co-founder of Asian Diaspora Cultural Collective Gold House, and Sylvia Kim, general partner of impact investing firm Sarah Cap Cares. They discuss the role that individuals, community organizers, business leaders, and legislators can play in stopping anti-Asian hate and violence. Kevin Rudd begins the conversation.
Sylvia, to you first. Have you been surprised by this outbreak over the last 12 months, or did you see it coming?
I'll be honest that I am not that surprised. And actually, this is a perfect segue just to talk a little bit, I think, about the long history of anti-Asian sentiment and xenophobia here in the United States. A lot of times, I think this past year, there's been a lot more awareness of it. It's the first time I think that there's been so many viral documentations, videos, pictures circulating on social media platforms. But I can assure you that this type of behavior is absolutely not new at all. For those who know the long history of what's called the Yellow Peril, there were Chinese massacres in the 1800s, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the shameful act of the incarceration of Japanese Americans, and then, of course, the hate crime in 1982, the death of Vincent Chen, who was mistaken to be a Japanese auto worker taking over the American economy, that led to his death and ultimately the rise of major civil rights institutions within our community. So I can say that, you know, it is disheartening. I would say that the most shocking thing for me has been this latent attack on the most vulnerable. So particularly on the elderly, particularly on women. I think that level of cowardice and bigotry and misogyny has been a little shocking to visibly see on our feeds on a daily basis. But I would say that overall, that sentiment has been part of the Asian American experience, unfortunately, for a long time. And, you know, one of the things that I'd love for us to speak about as we move forward is what can we do in terms of prevention? Because just like disease or crime, when you're in crisis mode, you want to stop the bleeding, right? By the time you're in the justice system, it's a little bit too late. And so I think that our community really has to take more of a preventative long-term perspective in terms of what we can do in face of this history.
Well, thank you for that. We will move on to a discussion about what we now do, both on the preventative side as well as community action, as well as action through the criminal justice system as well. Sylvia has pointed to the fact that this is not a new phenomenon in America. And even though I'm not an American, I've looked at all the acts of federal and state legislatures through the 20th century, and certainly in the 19th century, banning various forms of Asian immigration, restricting various forms of Asian immigration, and couched in utterly racist terms. The United States is not unique in this. My own country in Australia is just as bad historically, and there is still much evidence of racial harassment, racial assault against Asian Australians as well. But Bing, same question to you. Are you surprised at all by what we've seen in the last 12 months? Over to you, my friend.
I'm a millennial who's weathered the greatest economic recession in history in 9/11. So unfortunately, no disaster surprised our generation. So that's that. The only other elements I'd add to Cecilia's very astute and comprehensive articulation of the lack of surprise is, one, we all know that there's always a scapegoat for disasters. It was the Japanese during World War II. It was Muslims in 9/11. we, of course, are being scapegoated for COVID-19 that Asian Americans did not create, nor did we physically bring here. As Sylvia alluded to, I also want to, without decentering the Asian American experience, recognize that attacks against every single community, and particularly every minority community, are actually wrong. And if you look per capita, they're actually not even highest against APIs. And again, I say this delicately because we're in a moment and I want to recognize that. But when we say that an attack against one of us is an attack against all of us, that is numerically true right now because of the pandemic. So that's the only other piece I'd add. The final piece I'd say is, as Sylvia clearly also articulated, a lot of people are jumping with their, you know, posters and so forth to say, we need a national and state enforced definition of hate crime. We need more enforcement and punitive measures. But the reality is, if we wait for those sticks, we will be too late. And so we have a whole slate of sort of preventative, or what I call carrot measures, that we think are just as, if not candidly, more important for long-term rectification.
Well, let's move on to that part of it. But just before we do, you've mentioned the elephant in the living room, which is COVID, and the direct attribution in the minds of many ignorant Americans between the COVID scourge, which has been inflicted on America, more than 500,000 people dead. We have an economy which has had the guts kicked out of it. Huge impact in terms of federal government funding for stimulus payments to keep the economy rolling. And in the mind's eye of some in the United States, but obviously a significant and ill-informed minority, this is somehow the fault of Asian Americans. In the incident reporting that we've got across the country, is that part of the language that's being used directly against those who have been suffering assault in the streets, or is it just one part of the mix? Bing, over to you first. Back to you, Sylvia.
I mean, as you know, President Rudd, the pandemic was just gasoline fire in so many different ways, whether it was minority-owned businesses already suffering, whether it was women of color being scapegoated and penalized and fetishized in different ways. And so too, in this experience, this is merely gas to a fire that is known as perpetual foreigner, where Asian American Pacific Islanders have conditional acceptance in this country. And there's a litany of different examples that Sylvia alluded to earlier, from internment to legal exclusion. You don't just see this, though, as you know, on the streets and attacks. You see these sort of, this sort of pernicious perpetual foreigner, those syndrome and attacks, even in corporations where Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are the least likely demographic to be promoted in management, according to Harvard Business Review. You, once again, are welcome to a corporation, but are not invited or integrated enough to elevate yourself. And so that, again, the net is, this is just a gas on an existing fire. And unfortunately or fortunately, it is now incumbent on our community, as well as hopefully allies, to fix this problem that we did not ask for.
Sylvia, to what extent has COVID just been the gas on a pre-existing fire? How big is it as a dynamic in what we're seeing at the moment?
I think that the pre-existing fire was absolutely there. And again, we've talked a lot about that history, and I love what being said about the scapegoating of our community. I think that too oftentimes the whole concept of the model minority myth, that Asians accept microaggressions, you know, when you call someone a derogatory term racially to an Asian, it's a joke. You know, we're not being the ones gunned down. We're not being the ones that are being viciously attacked. And so I think that in a way, for generations, Asian Americans have allowed these microaggressions to continually light that fire, which now COVID has just pushed over the edge. I do want to acknowledge that I do believe that some of the previous administration's characterization of the virus has contributed to some of the conception that it is okay to associate Asians with the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think that that's been one of the key characteristics that have also lit the fire. And I would say that a lot of the initial incidents, of course, many of them are very violent, but have also tied Asians back to the flu, whether it's Kung flu, graffiti on Asian-owned businesses, Chinese virus, go back to your country, don't bring your virus here. Those kinds of, I think, verbal articulations of how Asians are being associated. And again, once again, being seen as the perpetual foreigner or the yellow peril.
Yeah, I think we should name it for what it is. I mean, Trump's use of the term Kung Flu, for example, is a repugnant act of racist politics. It's not even effective dog whistling. It's basically taking out a clarion horn and proclaiming to white America or to non-Asian American America that there are some people here who are appropriate targets for the scapegoating. And that for me just needs to be named for what it is. And before we move off it, to simply say, for anyone listening to this webcast, the bottom line is this, for God's sake, whatever the origins of the virus were in Wuhan, and that's the body of the evidence, the idea that you could in any way blame any Chinese person in the United States for what occurred in Wuhan is just mind-bogglingly stupid. Secondly, it is doubly mind-bogglingly stupid to think that a Korean-American, a Japanese-American, a Filipino-American, the poor woman who was bashed senselessly the other day in the streets of New York, or an Indonesian-American or others from South Asia and India as well, could somehow in any matter of logic be held responsible, even faintly and directly, for whatever went down in Wuhan at the last part of 2019, is just so brain dead it needs to be named as such. It's just totally and utterly brain dead as a proposition. Anyway, let's get on to solutions now that we've dealt with that one. I'm really taken by the language which both of you have used in different ways. Let me paraphrase it in these terms. You've described Asian Americans as being perpetual foreigners, but therefore reflecting on your own experience within the United States, that you would see yourself in the eyes of white Americans and non-Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners. And that the micro forms of racism are real and pernicious. As a colleague of mine said in the Asian Society the other day, whose partner is a Japanese American, there are so many things which white guys like me and him do not actually see because we are not Asian in the streets, but which in his case, his partner sees and feels on a regular basis. So explain to me a little further about what this is like as we transition our conversation into what now do we do about it? The micro racist experiences, the sense of being the permanent foreigners, despite the fact that you're both citizens of the United States of America and have been a long time. Bing, you first and then back to Sylvia.
I mean, like all things of being a multi-hyphenate Asian and American, there's a deep ambivalence to this, as you know, President Rudd. On the one side, for many of us, it can be incredibly hindering. What you hear is eventually what you believe and therefore how you behave and where you can and cannot go in society. If you hear that you are docile and submissive, you at some point may become docile and submissive because repetition makes prayers, makes people. But on the other side, I think the more optimistic piece that unfortunately not all of us have the privilege of having, whether it's because of our economic standpoint, our family makeup, our social acceptance, is this also makes us twice as tough. My mother used to say that you have to work twice as hard to get half as much if you're a minority in any way, which is to say you need to work four times as much to get just as far as everyone else. Now, that's annoying, but it's also really empowering. It means, you know, we have to actually fight back twice as hard. We actually have to out-earn twice as much to get our pace. And while that can, again, be very frustrating and impossible for some, for those who have the privilege or the fortitude to get there, there can actually be miraculous things. I'll tease one that we'll get into some of the longer term solutions. One of my favorite stats that we discovered at Goldhouse last year, our team discovered, was that 30% of the companies worth over $500 million founded in the last decade have at least one Asian American or Pacific Islander in this country founded. That means that 5.6% of people are controlling and contributing and leading and were invented. 30% of the most valuable companies in the world. And the reason this is powerful is not just because of economic mobility, of course, for them, but these people have completely reshaped and reimagined and invented industries that have been employed and are enjoyed by many millions around the world. We're talking, of course, about DoorDash, Uber, YouTube, and so forth. And so, again, I think there's this deep duality that has, of course, like all suns cast its shadow. But as long as we can stand in the light a little bit more and enable more people to, I think in the case of startups, for instance, we can find something really special.
Well, the startup community is big, and you're part of it, my friend, and it's gone pretty well. Sylvia, permanent foreigners, micro-racism, and let's transition into what now is to be done.
Absolutely. First, I do want to clarify that my background is actually in Canada. So I was born and raised in Canada, so another Commonwealth country, but did experience elements of that perpetual foreigner experience as well. And I did want to also just bring to our conversation the context that a lot of times when people think of Asians, similarly as they were associating COVID to anyone that looks remotely Chinese, it is one of the most diverse communities in this country. I think those at Asian Society, we know how diverse this community is. There's over 100 languages, 50 ethnic groups, and I'm not even going into the micro subgroups. And so one of the challenges, I think, with the Asian American experience is that it is so diverse. We come from such a massive, diverse range of countries with different cultures. There are some themes that tie us all together, but I would say that, you know, even among Asians, we don't even know all the nuances. And so that diversity, the fact that we're not a monolithic community, I think lends to some of the lack of understanding about how to approach Asians and how to approach Asians in America. All to say that in terms of my experience, I agree absolutely with what being said. I think a lot of us are immigrants in this country. I grew up with my parents owning a convenience store. If you know the nice sitcom Kim's Convenience, that's very similar to basically my childhood. And, you know, a lot of the experiences I had was, you know, you have to work twice as hard. You know, someone calls you some kind of derogatory, says there's no such thing as Korea. You just brush it off your shoulder and you work harder. But unfortunately, I think now that I've moved to the States and have worked for civil rights organizations, I do think that that kind of mentality has sometimes perpetuated the model minority myth and this perspective that only if we go to the top schools, only if we make it this far, only if we, you know, found this many companies or contribute this much to the economy, we will finally be accepted as full Americans. And I think what this whole pandemic has shown and has resurfaced is that the sentiment of the perpetual foreigner will not go away with no matter how much success we have as a community. What we ultimately have to do, and I know I'm jumping ahead again, but I think that the perception and the myth, the model minority, this perception that we have to work twice as hard and that's acceptable, the fact that we have to be apologetic if we feel bad that, you know, we're getting these microaggressions, all of those kinds of experiences, I think we have to now really be unapologetic and really claim that, you know, those kinds of submissive stereotypes are no longer going to be tolerated. And I can share for myself that not only do I have the sporting my short haircut, which I know is very unusual for women, there's a personal reason for that. We shaved our head to support my mother-in-law's cancer journey. My whole life, I was told that I'm not a typical Asian. You know, I practiced criminal law. I was a litigator. I was often told, you know, you're too loud, you need to be quiet. You know, whenever I walked into a courtroom in Toronto, I was often mistaken for administrative staff. So, you know, having personally experienced just how much more aggressive and assertive I need to be to say what I need to say and to be a voice, you know, I want to ensure that my children and that generations to come no longer have to apologize for how they look and how that does not match the stereotype of an Asian American.
Yeah, it's a fascinating reflection on how facile the intellectual frameworks of white folks can be on these questions. Like, I'm not described in the United States as a European American. If you think about it, I mean, the whole notion of being European. I mean, people talk about, you know, Irish Americans. They talk about German Americans, Italian Americans, etc. And anyone with a passing familiarity of this term of convenience called Asia will know that it represents more diversity than it in fact does unity. Vast civilizations of China, Japan, the Korean Peninsula, the Malay cultures of Southeast Asia, the Khmer cultures of Indochina, before you even get close to Hinduism in South Asia and other parts in between, you know, Buddhism in Thailand and in Myanmar, etc. This is just vastly diverse. People need to understand probably the term Asia in Latin means east. East of where? East of the West, where the white guys jumped in their boats one day to go out and discover the East, basically quite a long time after, in fact, various Chinese navigators have discovered the West, but we'll leave that to one side. So the whole aggregate stereotype of Asian Americans is even problematic in itself because it masks so much internal diversity. Bing, on the question of what we now do, what shall be done? If you're president of the United States in 20 years' time, or you're governor of California in 10 years' time, with a government hat on, but also with a corporate hat on and a community hat on, if I was to say, here are the three things that we can and must do as of today, this day in April of 2021, to turn this beast around, what would they be?
From your lips to my mother's ears, President Rudd, I think about this once again, dualities. Unfortunately, when you're trying to reimagine socioeconomic equity, there's multiple lanes that have to move in parallel, as you know. In a perfect world, they would be sequential, but we know that's not the world we live in. So the first would be both public and private sector investments in what I call carrots and sticks. The idea on carrots is for a functioning society, we need abundance, growth-building opportunities, prominent media portrayals that are accurate, economic investments to grow business and stabilize society, so forth and so on. But second is we also need sticks or corrective punitive measures when the carrots fall short, which we unfortunately know happens. The trick with sticks is we also want to make sure there are punitive measures that don't disenfranchise or disproportionately negatively impact certain communities that we know, at least in the state, have been historically biased against purely because of race. And so we need to be very careful there. The second piece is allyship. And I think about allyship in several ways, but most pronounced would be one, the origin of each of the multicultural communities' experience, whether they're indigenous First Nationers or they're the Black community or APIs or Latinos and so forth, are highly distinct. Asians do not have universal slavery, for instance. I'm glad we don't. We also, as Sylvia astutely articulated, we also don't have any convening apparatuses that sort of try to sort of attack persecution. But the way that we will tackle these and the solutions we will find are highly concentric. And the best example in our country, as you know from this, was in the 1960s, where because of the Black Panthers, because of Black leaders like MLK Jr., because of the NAACP, Asian and Pacific Islanders, Latinos and so forth necessarily had directly improved immigration, voting and so forth policies because of another community's leadership. And so fortifying sincere and sustainable relationships with those other communities and finding where our concentricity can align, whether it's in the policy world or in the private sector, is of paramount importance. The final piece that I think is maybe unpopular, but is certainly critical is Asian Americans and Latinos are dual nation individuals. Because of that, we have the fastest growing immigrant populations in the country. We will be the two largest minorities in the next 2.5 decades. And I think that responsibility of being in the West and having an understanding of this soft power, but also appreciating our heritage, where so much of multinational economic growth comes from, means that it is incumbent on us to bridge the world, to bridge North and South longitudinally, and to bridge East and West across the Pacific. And so the sooner that we can identify consistent, I think, social media, not internet, social media like Facebook, but social and media, as well as economic opportunities to bridge both sides, I think the faster we'll also not only just engender a greater face and a sort of more pronounced modern face of America, but one that is economically built to weather the next few decades, just as many other superpowers already have. Exhibit A, One Belt, One Road. So those are the first two. The final piece I'd say is a mental shift. So there's this sort of perpetual, is it hard to be a CEO of a Fortune 5 or is it hard to grow your own unicorn? And the punchline is they're both challenging in their own ways. And so I would encourage our communities collectively, and I mean ours humans, the human race, to not only, as we say, build a house that is your own, invent your own companies, invent your own industries, but also invest in correcting and taking other houses that maybe is systemically more singular in their approach, whether it's in who they elevate to C-suites, who they nurture and how they nurture, or even what they value. So those are the three again, sort of private public sector investment in carrots and sticks, allyship both with other cross-cultural communities as well as cross-continentally, particularly with South America and Asia, No offense to the other countries and continents of the world. You are also important. We are all wonderful snowflakes. And then finally, it's just that mental shift of building your own house as well as taking ones that exist.
We'd like to take a short break here to talk about an upcoming event. On Thursday, May 6, Asia Society Southern California and Asia Society Texas are co-hosting a special conversation on activism in response to racism and xenophobia. Panelists, including Georgia State Representative B. Nguyen, Stop AAPI Hate co-founder Dr. Russell Jung, and Compassion in Oakland founder Katrina Ramos, share their perspectives on how the current groundswell of support for Asians and Asian Americans can be sustained. You can find more information about this event and others at asiasociety.org/events. That's asiasociety.org/events. And now let's get back to the conversation.
The carrots and sticks. Okay, let's dwell for a little bit on carrots, and I'll flip to you in 1 second, Sylvia. And which in some respects is about, as you say, investment in communities, but associated with that deep attitudinal shift. What do white folks do about that? And what can and should they do about that?
I almost half want to hear from a white folk person, which would be you, President Rudd. So I'm curious there. But I mean, I think it's a couple of things. I think one, and this is easy for me to say as a minority, but as someone who is a majority in other places, I think the first mental shift is the world is not a zero-sum game. Someone else's rise in capacity, whether it's economically or otherwise, does not disenfranchise the incumbent. If it does, that means that the pie we were eating from was already limited to start out with and does not deserve to persist. And so if you look at, for instance, in media, when the when sort of Spotify and some of the music services sort of started to rise, traditional terrestrial radio freaked out. They thought suddenly here go all of our dollars, so forth and so on. But fast forward, both industries have actually risen. Now, of course, digital music is now superseded for a variety of reasons, terrestrial. But both still exist, both still thrive, and actually find the terrestrial radio for a variety of qualitative reasons maintains its qualitative prestige, which in the creative industry is just as important as actual hard dollars. And so I think the first mental shift is the pie grows larger. It doesn't get sliced up. How do we make it grow larger together? I think the second piece is understanding that the notion of race is not only one dimension of what's going on. Let's not forget there's gender, orientation, faith, and so forth. But also let's not forget the changing face of this country. Mixed race births and the growth of them had outpaced non-mixed race births for the past few decades, almost entirely driven because of Asian, and I mean Asian continental and South American immigration rates. And so this is not about white folk versus Asian or black versus blank. This is about, all right, how can we figure this out together? Because both biologically, but also in terms of solutions, we also have to unite there. So that's where I'd begin. The second piece would be to listen. This is really hard. I don't know. Sometimes I'm a good listener, depending on who you ask. But I think it's listening to each other to figure out what we each purely need, agnostic of any system that exists. And because humans are more concentric than we are different, this has been corroborated by loads of empirical research. Punchline is we all want strong professional impact and strong familial relationships. Everybody wants the same thing. Those may manifest, of course, differently. But because humans are highly concentric in their needs, I am extremely confident and built a career on the fact that different people are able to align most of the time if we just listen. I learned this just even in an anecdote at YouTube when I had to scale a partner program at the time from 33,000 partners to what became 300 million. And how do you support a large $320 billion market cap company like Disney and Burbank and an individual musician in Berlin? And the punchline is they all wanted the same six things that we then executed against in the exact same descending order. If artists and companies are that way, because these are run by people, I'm convinced that within social justice and so forth, we too can find very concentric solutions.
The concentric solutions are operating, as it were, in the corporate space, the entrepreneurial space, the startup space. I think if I'm hearing your argument clearly, that becomes a way of almost reverse engineering the country and pre-existing stereotypes, by which I mean from the ground up, everyone discovers that, in fact, they do have concentric circles of interest. And in fact, what happens is that when you grow the pie together, frankly, everyone gets a bigger and a more interesting slice of that pie.
That's right.
As opposed to seeing these things as competitive zero sum game pies, of which the crudest argument of the latter proposition is, you're here to take my job, which is stated at its, shall I say, at its racist worst, but polemically most effective in terms of, let's call it, far-right political movements who seek to exploit that.
That's right. So, and as you know, President Rudd, a lot of those offshoring of jobs, the majority have actually been automated. They have not even been off. And so all the more why, and by the way, to be clear, I don't blame those individuals who feel like they are, they're being disenfranchised by other minorities. I don't agree with them. They're patently wrong. But I understand where they're coming from, and I'm not entirely sure it's their responsibility to find their own new skill set in their own bubble. I think this is where it's incumbent on private and public sectors to fix a society that we have been complicit in building. I mean, just to extend this to racism, I majored in psychology as an undergrad. People are not born racist, is the punchline. There are loads and loads of evidence that shows that racism is taught, right? And so that makes me believe and also know once again that people are not born bad. People are born good and pure with a tabula rasa slate. The reason they become bad is because suddenly they can't afford to put food on the table. Suddenly they cannot feed mouths. Suddenly they're being evicted. And when that happens, when you have nothing, the way that you feel like you have something again, you exert agency, sometimes by convicting or finding others who are culpable. Now, again, I don't agree with that, but I understand that experience, and therefore it's responsible on the rest of us who have that privilege to create these spaces for socioeconomic growth for all to do so.
By the way, call me Kevin. I keep looking around my shoulder to see who President Rudd is, but
our Prime Minister. Sorry. I am being ethnocentric and trying to project our titles on you.
Look, it's a feeling of an Australian minority in the United States. I'm just feeling offended. just call me.
I had earlier.
Just call me Kevin. That'll be fine. But being as I flick to Sylvia on this, the bottom line is, any of us who've ever sat in a room with a bunch of preschoolers know that our children wonderfully are colorblind. And my two little grandkids are Chinese Australians. And so it is wonderful to see them in a group of multiple ethnicities. And frankly, in the world of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, this is just not even part of the consciousness. So therefore, the structural factors you alluded to are critical. Sylvia, in terms of the to-do list, you're about to become governor of California. You've beaten Bing in the primary, and you've been elected on your way to the White House 10 years after that. And so tell me, in terms of your top three, you can use Bing's carrot and sticks, or you can just go to sticks and then carrots, or whatever frame you want. What would be your top three?
Well, first, I want to actually change the structural, I think, assumption of that question, because I don't believe that you have to be the governor of California, or as being alluded to, that you have to be in some kind of elected official position to actually make a difference. So I hope you don't mind if I change that question around a little bit. And I'll say that I think that I actually wield more power as a private citizen, having access to capital, than I do sometimes as an elected official. And maybe that's just my jaded perspective after so many years in nonprofit organizations. But I will say that going back to kind of my framework of how preventive strategies are ultimately the most effective, I do believe that government and the public sector play a critical role in that. But I will say that in terms of the short-term strategies, the community, private citizens are the ones that have stepped up to the plate. And I know that Gold House has played a critical and pivotal role in really mobilizing the community and this kind of cross-sector, cross-industry, putting together celebrities with activists, the rallies that are happening, the fundraising that has been happening on GoFundMe. I think that those kind of short-term strategies have been very powerful to demonstrate, again, just the power that our community has. And there's never been more mobilization, I think, in terms of the visibility, at least. And it excites me, I think, as a hardcore advocate, to really see that kind of cross-sector collaboration. To go to the long-term strategies, and I think that's where, being shared a lot about the public-private sector, the allyship. First, in terms of the enforcement piece and the stick piece, I think having worked in the justice system and in and around the legal systems around the world, I would say that the thing that's really missing when it comes to the stick portion is a lack of cultural competency. And that's kind of a nonprofit jargony term, but anyone that provides social services to the Asian American community knows how complex that is. And again, that's going back to the fact that our community is not monolithic. We speak 10 plus different languages. So all of a sudden, when you're saying you're creating a hate crime incident reporting task force, what does that really mean for first generation immigrants that speak a variety of different languages and each have a different view on law enforcement? This is why kind of partnerships with social service and frontline community workers are so critical, because they're the ones that really know the community that they serve most. And this is also the reason why sometimes allyship is, you know, wonderful. And I love what you shared in the beginning of the story, your anecdote of going up to that person, but perhaps that particularly individual and how they interact with public entities is going to change very much based on their ethnicity and their experience in this country. So just a little context there in terms of the stick portion. Now, in terms of my kind of wish list of three things, I would say that the three long-term strategies that I wish could be implemented, whether it's as governor or as a public-private partnership, are threefold. One is in education. So what I see is a complete disconnect at times between what's happening right now and an understanding of our history, even some of the things that we talked about during this, kind of this forum right now. And there's this kind of this disconnect in terms of the trailblazing work that a lot of civil rights activists have already done. And so I think that that disconnect is a problem. And there has been a movement to incorporate Asian American curriculum within our education system. I think that needs to be done, not just for the Asian American community, but again, for those that are going to be wielding the sticks, for those that are in elected official positions. What does it mean when you say Asian? And I don't even think that elected officials understand how diverse our community is. So education to me is a long-term strategy that, you know, will have multifaceted approaches. The other main long-stream strategy is in how do we shift culture? And I think that that is where, again, groups like Gold House have done an incredible job in advocating for representation. But representation is not just in entertainment and media. It's in, you know, the actual elected officials. It's in, you know, who controls the media and the narrative that's actually shown to mainstream public in terms of, you know, the culture shapers, the writers, the influencers. And so I think that's, again, another long-term strategy that we need to invest in. And lastly, as being mentioned, allyship is one of those things that I think does not happen overnight. And, you know, having learned of just, what happened during the LA riots, the complexity of the relationship between the Asian and the African American community here in Southern California, you know, what happened during those 30 years? There has been some progress. And of course, there are those who have been at the forefront of those race relation conversations. But I would say that there hasn't been enough investment. And again, this is the preventative strategy, right? It's not about putting the Band-Aid on once the bleeding started. And we have to understand that when we take a systems perspective, the model minority myth and the whole concept of white privilege is to actually pit communities of color against each other. And so I think that this whole, breakdown sometimes of the relations between the Asian American and the African American community is really ultimately perpetuating white supremacy. And so in order to really dismantle those kinds of systemic, structural, insidious, kind of forms of racism and bigotry, there has to be so much work that's put in. And, you know, that's where I think a huge investment in terms of next gen leadership, who are going to be the ones that understand those intersectional identities, those identities that comprehend generational differences within the Asian American community, generational differences within the LGBTQ community, the African American community, and understanding just the intersectionality of those identities. That's actually the hard work, I think, that gives me hope, but I also know is also the least sexiest in terms of investment. And so I think that's where, you know, if I could do it, those would be kind of the three large overarching things that I would love to invest in terms of preventive strategies. And with the overarching understanding that anything that's done within our community has to have a level of cultural competency. Otherwise, it's just not going to reach those that need it most.
Okay. The education, culture, allyship. So, and what you and Bing seem to be saying together is that if we are able to craft a better world, it's an intersecting set of almost three arrangements whereby the legislative framework establishing norms, legal norms, is clear and enforced effectively, that the re-engineering of cultural norms at the softer edge occurs through private-public partnership and can be done effectively that way, but also by corporations of the type which you've both been talking about, just growing the cake and leading by an existential reality, which is diverse firms like this grow the cake and everyone gets to become who they wish to become. And that it is the creative interplay of these three sets of dynamics which bring about aggregate change over time. Bing, Sylvia has given you about 47 shout-outs for Gold House. So let me ask you, what is it and what the hell are you doing that's so good? So here is your Asia Society promo for a 60-second advertisement for what are you doing that's so brilliant out there, and give us some insights.
I think the first thing is it's not me. It's our incredible 100-plus person team and our incredible 1,000-person collective. So we'll start with that. The second piece is I wanted to name a Silver House because I'm Asian, but we insisted on gold. The third thing is always try harder. Great is not good enough. So welcome to Asian America.
When's Platinum House coming?
So small tangent. For April Fool's Day, we decided it was time to have something with levity and whimsy with no goal. And so we almost renamed ourselves to Platinum House for the day, but being self-effacing felt a little more appropriate. So we renamed ourselves to Silver House for the day. But next year will be Platinum, year after will be Diamond, and we'll go from there. Anyway, in all seriousness, I think the first step is we listened. We spent a lot of time 3 years ago, and fast forward, we're now the largest API cultural leadership collective, understanding why Asians have not historically convened. And it's exactly what Sylvia alluded to earlier. We are the most diverse race in the world, 50 ethnicities, hundreds of dialects stretched to every corner of the earth or every bend of the earth. We have no historic universal struggle. Thank God we don't have a universal historic struggle. We also don't have regular convening apparatuses like Shabbat dinner or church that so many of us love and grow up in. And so the question was, what is going to unify us? Why would we even come together? Because bringing people together is one thing. Getting them to stay and do something is much harder. And so to be pedantic Kevin, so weird to call you Kevin. Kevin Rudd, I'd love to
break out of the model minority myth.
I would love to hear like how you think about this, especially at a country level or continental level as well. But we realized that because Asian America as an idea is actually a legal term that's only less than 60 years old, we would not be united based on our history, but what we're doing tomorrow. And I think this is hopefully empowering to people, because while we do have to shed some of our societally imposed baggage, like the model minority myth that was weaponized us against the Black Panthers in particular in the 60s, as Sylvia mentioned, while we do have to shed perpetual foreigner syndrome, this is also a rally cry that our identity and cohesion is going to be based on what we can build tomorrow. And if you analogize this to what Singapore and the UAE have successfully done over the past decades and a half, they are now the economic powerhouses for all of Asia and the Middle East. Successfully, dare I say, I'll get in trouble, but displanting Hong Kong and Japan, period. And it's because they united on money. Because they united on something that is universal language that makes the world go round. So that insight was profoundly important to us. Now, what do? We have a systemic approach to engendering greater socioeconomic equity. So on the socio side, we collaborate and are the first API call for every major Hollywood studio, where we consult culturally on the authentic portrayal of APIs and scripts for films, all the way to ensuring the successful opening weekends, all the way to ensuring the successful wins. Now, I know this sounds a little soft because we all look at media and we think it's a little vain, it's a little frivolous. But the reality is that 80% of media traditionally that's exported worldwide comes from the United States.
So what we produce within the confines of Hollywood, within the World Trade Center in New York City, is necessarily what the world believes. And when you look at film as a format, film is still widely regarded as the high art. Now, music and sport and TV will sometimes be progenitors to things like diverse inclusion and casting and so forth. But the reality is nothing is taken seriously until film moves. And so we built this end-to-end funnel to ensure that our stories were accurately and prominently told and have so many times made history. And we are the dominant marketing reason why Parasite, a mostly non-English, entirely, excuse me, non-English film, was the best performing film by per theater average opening weekend pre-pandemic. And so being smart about what unites us through money, speaking the language of old systems and thinking about it from an end-to-end approach is one part. The other part, just for to end this out, and this is where Sylvia and I actually spend our day jobs in many ways, but is on the economic side. We know that C-suite executives and board directors make decisions. There are two paths there. One, you can go through a traditional corporation and by God love you if you have succeeded there. Maya Korangle, Arise Fund, Mark Tatum over the NBA, Monty Maceda, Worldwide CEO Bain. We love all of them. We celebrate their journey, Indra Nui. But the reality is there are very few of those spots and those take decades to get to. And so instead, we focus on small businesses or startups or Main Street, as they call it in Washington, D.C. And as I mentioned earlier, 5.6% of this country is delivering 30% of the top companies that have reimagined industries. That is a great source of power, not just because you are your C-suite if you found your company, but you control your board and who gets on from day one. And so anyway, so we have just a comprehensive slate of stuff there. I think the final piece is really important is we were never built for and by Asians. I, as a third culture kid who grew up not seeing himself as Asian, but first and foremost as a human being, it's fundamentally important to me that we not just build singularly and selfishly. It's important that we, and our mission is really targeted towards socioeconomic equity for APIs, but in order to put us in a position to serve, unite, and lead so many other communities, whether it's because we have this Pacific Bridge responsibility, whether it's because we should just deploy our research to others because it's cardinal law or otherwise. So let's go last in a nutshell. Can go into much more detail, but that's that.
I know, Kevin, and I hope you don't mind if I share just another reason why I think I was making those shout outs and also make a couple of other shout outs, because actually it ties back to because it does tie back to Asia Society. I will say that when I joined Asia 21 in 2016, I was full-fledged in civil rights and international human rights policy. You go into law school thinking that that's how you're going to change the world, using law, using policy. And my specialty area was North Korean human rights, which, Kevin, if you know at all, in DC has not really moved the needle very much over the past decade. So all to say, you know, I was a very serious international human rights scholar. I just completed my master's in law. And I came to Asia 21 in Seoul. It was a Seoul summit in 2016. And the keynote speaker that year was Neil Cross. And he was known as the world's most disruptive innovator. And I will tell you that it blew my mind. Actually, Asia 21 was very special to me because it was in that room full of entrepreneurs, many of them social entrepreneurs, and many of them advocates, but experiencing and executing advocacy in such innovative, creative ways that a new Sylvia was really born. And I always joke around that that was the moment where I knew that what I was doing in terms of my advocacy and human rights work was not effective. And I had to be very honest that there are different ways to solve problems. And that's, you know, many years fast forward, why I'm now a venture capitalist who invests in early stage technology. And so actually, you know, there's an incredible book called The Medici Effect, which others, many, it's a best-selling business book. It's about innovation. And it's really about when you intersect different unlikely things together that the greatest innovations occur. And so I think Gold House is definitely an example of that. To me, it was an innovative approach to Asian American civil rights advocacy. There are many other examples. For example, I know that I'm involved with a group called NFT for Good that are now using non-fungible tokens in the crypto world to also advocate for what's happening against Asians. You know, there are things that I see every day that are intersecting technology, very age-old social impact perspectives, women founders, diverse founders, and making sustainable impact. And so I think for me, it's just really opened my eyes that when you want to move the needle, when when you do the same thing over and over again and it's not working, it's time to change the method. And I think that when Gold House came onto the Asian American scene, at the time we were just launching the National Asian American Community Foundation, it was such a fresh breath of air and an example of what third culture next generation folks are going to bring to the table. And I say that in hopes and raising two children myself and knowing that, you know, their approach to the world, their approach to their Asian American identity and their kind of unlikely intersections of how they're going to be approaching these age old problems of race relations, of xenophobia. These are things that, you know, I don't even think we're ever going to uproot them actually, but how do we manage them? You know, it's almost like a chronic disease, you know, but I think that those fresh and different perspectives, I think, has really shaken, I think, the community. At the same time, of course, we need to have those connections to the trailblazers and to the anchors and those that have those lived experiences. But to me, that kind of innovative intersection and the reason why I'm currently in my day job now in the space of VC and innovation really actually roots back to my Asia 21 Summit in Seoul.
Thank you for listening to Asia in Depth. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, and check out past episodes at asiasociety.org/podcasts. That's asiasociety.org/podcasts. I'm Michelle Flor-Cruz. See you next time.